Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome, Afelich and Chanukah. Okay, so tonight I want to talk about the concept of fighting beauty with beauty. There's much to say about the concept of beauty, certainly when it comes to Yavon, when it comes to the nation of Greece, which we are dealing with that battle over this Yontif, and the concept of the beauty that they expressed into the world and brought to the world, and the concept of beauty from a Jewish perspective, from a Torah perspective. And generally, as I wrote in the blurb, as in describing the class, we generally shy away from the concept of focusing on the external beauty and really pay much more attention and focus on that which is internally beautiful, the value of what's inside as opposed to that which is on the outside. That is a prime Torah value of recognizing, looking beneath that which is there and seeing that which is truly the value of what's underneath. Yeah, we find many instances of the value of beauty in the Torah. It's your first source on your sheet is where we find the concept that runs throughout all mitzvahs of the Torah. In Oz Yashir, the song that the Jewish people sing upon crossing the sea, following the exodus from Mitzrayim, we have the phrase, Zeh Keliva Anveyu, this is my God, and I will beautify him. And the Gemara has a drasha based on the fact that it's really difficult to beautify God. We have enough of a difficult time talking to him. What would it mean to beautify him? How do you do that to an incorporeal being such as God himself? So the sages understand really what that means when we say that this is my God and I will beautify him, I will beautify myself before him in my mitzvos. So that the mitzvos that I do should be done in a beautiful way. The Gemara says, I only brought here the English, Hisna elefanav, beautify yourself be mitzvos. You make a sukkah. Don't just throw a sukkah together. Don't make it shlaki. This is a mitzvah. Therefore, as a mitzvah, it should be done in a beautiful manner. You should have a beautiful lulav, a beautiful shofar, beautiful tzitzis, a beautiful Torah. The Gemara gives a whole list. And this is a concept of beauty which goes throughout all mitzvahs. All mitzvahs should be done in a beautiful manner because recognizing it is a mitzvah, and it's through that that we are going to glorify and beautify ourselves before Hashem. Very nice. So if I then put that into the world of Hanukkah, and I said, how would this concept apply to Hanukkah? What would it mean, Hisna'el is fun of, beautify yourself in front of him in mitzvahs? What should it mean? You should have a beautiful menorah. Well, the menorah should be seen by people. More than the menorah, really it should be a beautiful... You should have beautiful oil. Because really the menorah is really just that which is going to hold it. And the oil should be beautiful. It should burn beautifully. That's how the concept would have translated when it comes to Hanukkah. If we beautify that which we do, so we should beautify that how we handle Hanukkah as well. And therefore the mitzvah of Hanukkah, the way that we fulfill it, should also be done in a beautiful way. Which is true. You will find that concept that you should have a beautiful menorah and you should use olive oil.
Shouldn't your thoughts and intents when you light the menorah, I mean, doesn't that help
beautify? You can say that, but that would already be something different. The Gemara says when you do a mitzvah, it should be done beautifully. So it's certainly true that you should also have beautiful thoughts, but that's already beyond that which the Gemara says you should do things in a beautiful way. Everything that we do should be done in a beautiful way, and your mitzvah should look beautiful. So if that translated to Hanukkah, we should light, the oil should be beautiful, the menorah should be beautiful. We're going to see now the Gemara has an entirely different perspective, a Gemara which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, in terms of how we beautify the mitzvah of Hanukkah, unique element. The Gemara says, it's number two on your sheets, the Gemara says the basic mitzvah of Hanukkah is really only lighting one candle per household. Every household should have a single candle, and that candle is the mitzvah of Hanukkah. It's very rarely done today, unless the person is either traveling or unable to do anything, but that's all they have. In Europe, it was much more commonly done, simply because oil was expensive, and the poverty that was rampant in Europe actually allowed that halacha to be much more commonly fulfilled than today. But that's the mitzvah. The mitzvah is a single candle. The Gemara then says, v'hamahadrin. Now, mahadrin is a tough word to translate, so I put a whole sentence to try to translate and capture what exactly mahadrin means. Mahadrin would mean those who either wish, it literally means hider, means to beautify. Hiddur mitzvah is the general concept of beautifying a mitzvah. So those who wanted to beautify the mitzvah of Chanukah, Hamahadrin, would be those who want to embellish it, those who want to perform it in a splendid manner, want to make it beautiful. What do they do on Chanukah, the Gemara says? So they light one candle per person in the household. So not just one candle, but if you have five people in the household, now you have five candles. And this is a more beautiful way of fulfilling the mitzvah of Chanukah than simply the main mitzvah, which is simply having a single candle. I have five candles, there are five people in my household, I have five candles. Says the Gemara, and hamahajin, min hamahajin, those who want to beautify it upon the beautification, those who really want to embellish and make it something special. So that the Gemara presents their two opinions. We're not going to get into the details of the different opinions. Beishamai says, on the first day you start with eight candles, and then you decrease it down to one every succeeding night you go down. Eight the first night, one on the last night. And Beis Hillel says, what we're familiar with as we practice, you start with one on the first night and ascend up to eight on the final night. Now again, what is this concept of one down to eight? This is the opinion, those who want to beautify it upon those who want to beautify. The primary mitzvah is just having a single candle. Those who want to beautify light, candle per person. And if you really want to beautify it, then either Beis Shammai going eight to one or one to eight. What's the reasoning behind this? So it's on your sheets, we're not going to go through it inside. Let's just talk about Beis Hillel. Either because it should represent how many nights have passed. There's a message. Tonight's the first night, second night, the third night. Or that you should be ma'ale v'kdusha ve'emurid. And you always go up in levels of sanctity and you never go down. You should always be increasing. Now, there's something interesting about this whole concept different than the regular Hiddur mitzvah. What's the regular Hiddur mitzvah? The regular beautification of a mitzvah is simply, I can either make a shlaki sukkah or I could make a beautiful sukkah. I simply change the quality of the mitzvah that I'm doing. I could buy a cheap lulav, or I could buy a beautiful lulav. And here by Chanukah there's something different. What's happening here?
More.
It's more, going either from one to eight. And it's not only more, there's a message. Why do we go from one to eight? You can probably right, to increase the level of Kedusha. To connect the yomim hayot and the days that have gone by, that it should be a met. When you see the candles, I now see them. If I only did the primary mitzvah, what would I see? I would see one candle in a household, and I would say, "Oh, it's Chanukah. What's the purpose of this candle? To increase the persume nisa, that the miracle should be spread around the region." That's only a single candle every night. But now I see either five candles because there are five people in the house, or I see in every night something different. I see one, then I see two, I see three, four, five. Everything is going up. So the hiddur is no longer just taking the same mitzvah, and instead of paying $50 for a lulav, I'm going to spend $70 and have a really nice one. That's hiddur mitzvah. The mitzvah can be fulfilled for $50, but do it in a beautiful way. Do something special. That's the regular hiddur mitzvah. Chanukah is different. The mitzvah is fundamentally different when you beautify it than it is if you do it in a simple manner. In other words, I would compare it to, let's say you want to do a hiddur mitzvah on lulav. Why don't we say this? Why don't you buy three lulavim and a srogim? And instead of just shaking it once, you'll do it three times. Mm-hmm. Or the hiddur mitzvah is to buy per people in the house, 8 days, 7 days of sukkah is really the Torah. Why don't we take the lulav one time on the first day and two times on the second? There's no such thing like that. The element of hiddur mitzvah is just take your mitzvah and do it in a beautiful manner. Chanukah is a fundamentally different type of hiddur. Not only do we do it in a beautiful manner, we change the way that we do it, and there's a message of the hiddur. It should say something. It should say, go up in levels of sanctity. Start with Kedusha and one, go up. Always increase. Or it should tell you how many days. There's something fundamentally there. Why by Chanukah do we find this different concept of Hiddur mitzvah? Not only that, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, you want to find out what's the halacha. Shulchan Aruch says a very funny thing. Shulchan Aruch, that's where you go to know Jewish law. What do you think it should say when you look at the laws of Chanukah? How do you light? What should it say? It should say the way to light Chanukah candles is one candle. It should go through the Gemara. Light one candle per household. And if you really want to do it nicely, light the number of candles per members of your household. And if you really want to do it nicely, then each member of the household you should lie in ascending order. You know what the Shulchan Aruch says? Skips the first two steps and says there's a statement of fact. How do you light Hanukkah candles? You should light in ascending order per the day going up from 1 to 8. As if there's nothing else. We go straight to the top when it comes to Hanukkah. We don't start with, this is really what you should do, but if you really want to beautify the... You wouldn't even know that there's such a Gemara. You would just know, if you looked in the Shulchan Aruch, this is how you light Hanukkah candles. You start with one and you go up in order according to the day that's passing through. Look in the other commentaries, they'll say, oh, and by the way, if you can't afford it or if you're traveling, you can't manage it, you can get away with only one. So it's as if we go straight to this facet of the most beautiful of the beautiful, specifically on Hanukkah. Okay, that's the problem, so to speak, understanding why it is that Hanukkah has such an element of beauty. Now, beauty and Hanukkah have a lot in common, and that's because it goes all the way back to Noach. We'll just reference the pasuk, it's number 3 in your sheets if you have your sheets. Noach, after the episode with his sons, after he gets drunk, after following the building of his ark, parenthetically, everybody saw in the paper today, where was it, in...
The
in the Netherlands? Yes, in the Netherlands, somebody built a real life-size ark. It's huge, 470 feet wide, all the dimensions, it's enormous. You should check it on the AJC. I have some copies of the article upstairs, thanks to Dina Conover. Since I referenced Noach, I have to mention that. It's a tourist attraction. You can go check it out, see a real life-size teva. In any case,
so
no...
Yeah.
What's that?
Filled animals?
They filled it with stuffed animals.
Okay.
But there's room. Yeah, she's got it right there. In any case, the Noach comes out of his actual real-life teva, and he gives a bracha, so to speak, to his son Yefes. Yaft Elokim liYefes, the Yishkon ba'ohal Eshem. He says to his son Yefes, Yaft Elokim. Literally, Rashi translates as Hashem should expand you. You should get out into the world. And the Gemara understands from the word Yaft, Yofi, is a word of beauty, that Yefes should be beautiful. There should be beauty through you and your descendants, Yefes. The Yishkon ba'ohal Eshem, but that beauty should be within the tents of Shame. We, the Jewish people, are descended from Shame. And Greece traces itself back, the nation of Greece, to Yefes. And they have a bracha of being beautiful. Beautiful in the tents of Shame. But there's a beauty there. There is a beauty. The Greek culture brought architecture, art, science, music. They brought all of that culture in to the world. It was later superseded by the Roman culture, which is the Western civilization that we live in. But they were known, famous for that which they brought to the world. They were a very sophisticated culture. And indeed, one would have thought that the Chachamim of the times, the sages, would have actually appreciated a culture that was so thoughtful, that was so intelligent, that was into creating and developing, and that actually brought a tremendous amount of light, so to speak, to the world. I have here a quote I found from Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill writes in his History of the Second World War that no two cities have counted more with mankind than Athens and Jerusalem. Which is true. When you think about what's been brought to the world scene, if you have to find and limit it, these two cities have had the greatest impact on world culture and history, bringing us to where we are today. Says Winston Churchill, you wouldn't go past the two cities of Athens and Jerusalem and that which they represent in the culture that they have brought. Their messages in religion, philosophy, and art have been the main guiding light in modern faith and culture. Personally, I've always been on the side of both, he writes. As a historian and as a non-Jew, first of all, just that he put Jerusalem in there, recognizing what the Jewish people have added to all societies of note. But the Gemara has often understood the two powers of Athens and of the Jewish people of Yerushalayim. And you would think, in his mind, they have brought the guiding light. He uses the words, the guiding light to mankind has been brought by these two cultures. Which makes it fascinating, because how do the sages, how do Chazal see Greece?
Darkness.
Darkness. Now, we have a machlokes here between Winston Churchill and our sages. So I can tell you how this one's going to end. But we have to to understand it. So Winston Churchill sees him as bringing the guiding light to the world. And from his perspective, he's right. Art, philosophy, culture, you name it. Greece brought it into, before then, it was, you know, this is not even the Dark Age. This is, you know, obviously well before the period of the Dark Age. But we were living in a Dark Age period of world history, and they enlightened the world. So that historians, 20th century, would say, Athens and Jerusalem, the two guiding lights. And Chazal, look at the first, the second pasuk in all of Chumash, of a Haaret, Ha'isosohu, Va'avohu, it was devoid, it was desolate, V'choshech al p'nei sahom, with darkness on the face of the deep. And as we've referenced many times, they see within this verse the four exiles that the Jewish people are going to experience. Tohu, Va'avohu, the exiles of Babylonia and Madai, the exile, the word Choshech, of darkness, represents the exile of Greece. And Tahom, the depth of the sea, represents Edom, the Golos that we are in right now. Parenthetically, we've spoken about in previous occasions how the sages see in the beginning of the Chumash that it opens with exile, that it's built into creation, that the story of our people will have exile in it. Part of what we need to learn as we go through world history until we get to the point where we need to be is the concept of exile. Each exile has lessons to be learned. We're at the end of the last of those exiles, the end of a 2,000 year exile, the fourth of the four. The third of the four was Greece. And they find it in the word Choshech, darkness. Greece brought darkness to the world. And they brought light to the world. From a world perspective, they did. A historian would look at it and say they enlightened the world. But the sages, they don't quite see it that way. They don't see its beauty, they see darkness. So I'd like to share a thought from Rav Aaron Lapiansky, the Rosh Yeshiva in Silver Spring, Maryland today. Very brilliant writer and thinker and philosopher. I want to share a thought that I saw he writes about when it comes to Hanukkah, and I think explains this issue that we're discussing. He writes about the concept of beauty. What makes something beautiful? You have a beauty contest. why is this person more beautiful than that person? Why is this painting beautiful? Why is the sunset beautiful? What makes something beautiful? What makes it appeal?
Features.
What about its features?
Reflect God.
It touches the heart.
I think so.
Well, there's something that I've seen in other places also.
Symmetry.
It's symmetry. Excellent. Symmetry creates beauty. When you see, and there are, I've read an article, I remember in the past, on facial features. What defines beauty is a face that's perfectly symmetrical. We just see it and we say, that's beauty. Beautiful. Now, we can find other things attractive also, and all of our faces are pretty much symmetrical. It would be a real mess if it were like totally asymmetrical. But there's something about symmetry that creates beauty in the eye of the beholder. Whether or not it's in nature, whether or not it's in a person, it's in a piece of art. When things are, you go to an extreme, when it's chaotic, it might be cool or modern, but it's not beautiful. There's a symmetry that you see in something that's just beautiful. Now, besides for on the material plane, where on the physical plane, that beauty really has another element to it. And there are a couple of words that the Chumash, the Torah, uses to describe concepts of beauty. The primary one, I just wrote them down so you should see them in front of you, the concept is yofi. Yofi is the word which describes beautiful. Something is yafeh. It's nice. It's beautiful. Yafte lokim liyafes, the bracha that Noach gives to his son. You should have that beauty. That's the primary word that's used to describe or define something that's beautiful. There's another word that's used, or several words. The other one that we're talking about tonight is the concept of hod. Now, hod, which often is translated as glory, is described by the Mefarshim in Tanakh to mean a form of beauty, but it's more than just beauty. It's a specific type of beauty. It's that majestic and awesome beauty, an overwhelming beauty that almost creates a sense of fear when you see it. because you're overwhelmed by it. That's hod. Now, hod is a tricky word because it appears in a lot of different contexts. Chanukah, we find it, v'hodos u'lehallel, that the nature of the day was established for, how do we use hodos there? Giving thanks. Moda ani is a giving thanks. The word hodah is a word which means thanks. It also means a recognition or an admission of doing something wrong. I admit to something. The Gemara uses a term called moda b'miktas. Person who admits that he actually, the person claims he gets him $100, he admits to 50. He's a moda, I admit, I acknowledge that on those 50, yes, you are correct, and I indeed borrow them. So we have moda, meaning an admission of or acknowledgement of guilt, means to give thanks, and it has an element of beauty, and an overwhelming type of beauty. So Rabbi Lapiansky writes, the concept of beauty as a concept of symmetry not only applies to symmetry in the physical being that's in front of you, be it a painting or a facial feature, but that it reflects the nature of what you see as well as its true value. So that when you take the concept of beauty to the next level, you're not only looking whether or not you're thinking these things in your mind or not, but what you're assessing as you're viewing something is how does what I see reflect what is? I mean, the world was created on a physical plane, and then beyond the physical plane that we see, there is a deeper spiritual component to it. And when we see something, you can go through a process of measuring, what do I see? Is it an accurate reflection on the physical to that which is really going on beneath it? And there's three ways that this can manifest itself. Sometimes you see something that's magnificently beautiful, and inside is a train wreck. It's repulsive. You can meet a beautiful person on the outside, but on the inside, they're a mess. Gemara has a term for that, in which you could put a golden ring on the nose of a chazir, on the nose of a pig. So does that make the pig beautiful? No. You now have a pig wearing a golden ring. It doesn't make the pig beautiful. Sometimes when you see beauty, we would call that a yofi of sheker, or a yofi of hevel, in which there's a beauty there. On the external, I see something beautiful, something maybe symmetrical, or something which gives off, however as a culture will define, something of beauty. I see it there, but it's hollow inside. It's really, there's nothing there. So that is what we would refer to as a sheker, it's a yofi of sheker. It's not really beautiful. The outside it is, but it doesn't accurately reflect that which is going on inside. Second manifestation is where it does accurately manifest itself. You see something beautiful on the outside, and it is an accurate description of its true inner value. When you see it, and it is what it is, and it's accurate. It's a beautiful person on the outside, a beautiful person on the inside. Whatever it is that you're holding, its true weight, its true value, is accurately reflected by the beauty that you see on the outside. And that's yofi. That's the term what we would refer to as true yofi. It's true beauty. Because not only does it give you the beauty on the outside, the externals manifest itself, but what is beneath it, what's poking through, is indeed accurately reflecting what you see. So far, so good? Mm-hmm. There's a third. And that's when the outer beauty that you see can't contain the inner beauty that's really inside. It's an attempt, but that the value is actually greater or bursting through that which you see. That's the concept of hod. Moshe, when he comes down from Har Sinai, has a glow, and he has to cover it with a masveh, with a mask of sorts. Rashi refers to that as his karnei hod, his rays of glory, beauty, but an overwhelming beauty, where you're in the presence of someone or something, and the spiritual value inside almost can't be contained by the beauty that you see on the outside, and it's almost bursting through. That's the concept of Hod, that there's more beneath the surface than what you see. So that the Yofi of Sheker is where there's less beneath in its spiritual plane than what I see. I'm being shown a shell of something, but it's really not there. True Yofi is where it's an accurate reflection. There's something beautiful, and its spiritual value is equivalent to that which I see. And Hod is when you enter into the realm of something that I see. You see a Talmud Chacham, you see a glow, you see a Moshe Rabbeinu, and there's a glow, there's something deeper there that you can't even fully grasp, that can't be contained by the shell that's covering it, as beautiful as it is. And it leads to a hodah, recognition, almost, of something that's there. In almost everything Jewish, I would say, there's this concept of beneath the surface is its true value. In other words, we live in, it's true in all aspects of life, but when it comes to the Yofi of Torah, or the Hod, that highest plane when you go through the Sfiros, of in between Pesach and Shua, so the highest level of all is this concept of Hod, before you get to Malchus, is where there's a inner value that's bursting through. Anyone familiar with the World Mask? Or like Akiva Tatz wrote a whole book called The World Mask. The entire book is about, you see on the outside something, but there's something deeper beneath it. So in this, he writes, is the clash between Greece and Yerushalayim, between Athens and Yerushalayim. The Greek philosopher, the Ramban, writes about this. They were a philosophical group, and the goal was to understand, to explore, to look into something, and to explain and understand. But there was an overriding concept to that, which was, if I can't understand it, then it can't be right. It doesn't exist. It was a supremacy of the human mind. They brought architecture and art, and science and math, and all these wonderful things in philosophy. As the Ramban writes, but it was a constant quest to explain and to understand in a very rationalistic way. And if you can understand it, I accept it. And if I don't understand it, then I don't accept it. This is a claim that we hear all the time. Until this day, as we bring in Jews who are educated without Torah, if you can explain it to me, I'll do it. But if you can't explain it to me, then I won't do it. Which is, it's not unfounded. That's an attitude that's existed in the world for many, many years. But it's an attitude which says, I need to have it in front of me, and to see it, and feel it, and touch it, and understand it. And if I can understand it, then I'll go ahead with it. If I can't understand it, I won't. The response to that, in a simple way, is the Kotzke Rebbe, who was once questioned by one of his Hasidim, some tragedy or another, I don't know what was going on in the town at the time, and someone said, how can you believe in a God who does something like this? Can you explain this, Rebbe? And he said, no, I can't explain it. So how do you continue to believe and serve a God that does incomprehensible things? And his response to that was, how in the world can a person serve a God that they do understand? What do I need that for? I can do it myself. So the concept in Torah is a concept of, there's a world that we see, there's a physical creation that you can touch and hold in your hands, but that beneath that, there's something beyond that. And that the culture clash is a starting point in which the Greeks said you can't have Shabbos, you can't have Rosh Chodesh, no Mila. The whole concept of a spiritual existence which is beyond that which can be explained as a culture, and I'm simplifying a much more complex concept right now, is antithetical to the Greek culture. And what they brought was an element of beauty, a lot of beauty to the world. But the sages saw in its darkness. They saw in all of that beauty, which a historian would write centuries later, was the greatest bringing of light into the world, and they see only darkness. Because if you take beauty on the outside and it's empty on the inside, that you don't believe in something that's beneath that surface, to something that's driving it, that's actually giving it life underneath, that from a Jewish perspective is pure darkness. It's completely losing the sight of the goal, which is the beauty underneath, the value inside, and seeing only the outside veneer, and it's pure darkness. The Bach, who's one of the classic commentators, describes there's a classic difference that you're all familiar with between Chanukah and Purim that's discussed every year. If you haven't yet heard it, I'll say it now so that you can say you hear it every year.
Okay.
And that is Purim. The way that we celebrate Purim is with good food. We sit down, we have a meal, you send food to your friends. It is the Seudah is part and parcel of the mitzvah of Purim, whereas Chanukah doesn't have any food aspect. I believe it's the only Jewish holiday on the calendar that doesn't have food associated with it as a part of the mitzvah.
Fried food.
Even fast days have food affiliated with it. Fast days of Yom Kippur has a meal right beforehand, which is part of the Torah. The Torah wants you to have a meal. Even Tisha B'Av has a meal the 2 seconds beforehand. So even our major fast days have food affiliated with it. Certainly all of the holidays do. And Chanukah is the only yontif that has no food element. We could eat fried foods all that we want, or maybe we shouldn't eat all the fried foods that we want, but the concept of the fried foods is because of the oil that's been, it's well below the status of everything else. There's no mitzvah. If you went through an entire Hanukkah and did not eat a single donut or latke, not even one, you would have fulfilled all the mitzvahs in as superlative a way as you can. So it's just not part of the answer.
I can't use that.
No, you can't use that one. Not with Hanukkah. So why is that? So the Bach writes, as many do, that when it came to Purim, the decree was against the bodies of the Jewish people. Haman wanted to destroy the Jews, whether they were interested in converting to whatever he wanted them to come. He didn't care what they were. If you were a Jew, he wanted you dead. And therefore, when we emerge victorious, Chazal established, we will celebrate it in a physical manner to say, we are here. And we will eat, and we will drink, and we will say we are here simply because you, Hashem, allowed us to be here. Chanukah was a different story. Chanukah, if the Jews would have said, as the majority of Jews at the time did, we want to be like you, we want to take on your culture, we want to have a part of your society, we want to be as Hellenistic as the next, the Greeks would have welcomed us with open arms and said, we don't have anything against you. In fact, we want you to be part of us, as Greeks, and bring in your culture to us. Translate your Torah into Greek. We want it to be part of our whole plan. And the Bach writes that started because of a weakening of the Avodah, a weakening of the Jewish service in Hashem is what brought about the calamity. In the same way as Purim, what started it was going to the meal of Achashverosh they weren't supposed to do. They started by eating where they weren't supposed to. The decree came against their physical bodies, and we celebrate physically with eating. Chanukah started, the Bach writes, because there was a general weakening of Torah observance. The decree came against Torah observance, and the salvation came with Mesiras Nefesh, with a group of Jews coming together and saying something which is impossible to do. We're going to do it anyway. We're going to literally sacrifice our lives, because a life without Torah is not a life. And we're going to take up arms, a group of farmers, small, unarmed, untrained, taking on the massive Greek army, but that's what we're going to do. So that the calamity began with a weakening of service, the decree was against the ability to serve, and the salvation comes when the Jewish people, the Kohanim, say, we will do it anyway, we will take up whatever we can. So Rabbi Liatsky concludes this thought by saying, the whole idea of understanding the beauty of beneath the surface comes from that concept of Mesiras Nefesh. Mesiras Nefesh says, I'm going to sacrifice. I'm going to do something. When you look at it, you say, it can't be. I can't succeed in this. It's not much of a sacrifice if you say, it's easy, what's the big deal, just do it. If you could look at it and say, it's doable, it's easy, so then you can do it. When you give up yourself and you say, it doesn't make sense. We can't possibly survive or win this war, this small little band of soldiers against an entire army, but we're going to do it anyway, is recognizing that despite the fact that the culture around you tells you, look at what you see, and whatever you see, that's what you get, says that there's something much deeper inside that's really there and driving it. And when the Jewish people said, that's how we're going to fight this war, we're going to fight this war with an understanding of that which is beneath the surface, deeper than that, from that the salvation comes. So when the Jewish people express themselves in that format of Mesiras Nefesh, of not looking at what's in front of them, what's feasible, what's possible, but doing it anyway, from that the miracle comes. And the sages establish the way that we'll celebrate that miracle is going to be in the realm of beauty. They're going to take the beauty and the light that Greece brought to the world, that which was introduced through their understanding of the arts and architecture and science and medicine and all the things that they did, and philosophy, and say, but they created an empty shell. The light of the menorah, that the miracle happens, that Hashem takes the flask of oil and says, that's going to continue burning, we are going to celebrate, and the way that we're going to do it in every way is going to be an expression of a beauty. Not just the regular beauty of you should have a beautiful menorah and a beautiful oil that burns well, but that the way that you fulfill the mitzvah is, we're going to set it up as, here's the primary way to do it, but we want you to do it in a more beautiful way. Because literally, the title of we fight beauty with beauty is true. But we don't just fight beauty with the same external veneer. We're going to use beauty in the realm of the way that we fulfill our mitzvahs. We're going to use beauty for people who were most or nefesh to go beneath the surface to do that which would have otherwise been impossible. And then the entire yontif is going to be established specifically in the concept of that hod, in a concept of beauty, which gets us to the halal and the hodah. Halal always applies in every yontif. There's halal. All the yontif when we say halal. But in Chanukah they set it up in a different way. Not only is it halal, but it's lahodos. It's in a form of giving thanks, of acknowledging that which took place, together with the hallel of the praise. And the word lahodos, which is to give thanks, is that same concept of when I recognize that there is more here than I can have. The hodah, the admission of guilt, comes from the sense of what you see, like the rays that come off of Moshe, which belie his true value, you have to acknowledge that it doesn't really hold it. And you have to acknowledge that which is there is beyond what's there. And it's all shared in that same kind of roots of the acknowledgement and the expression of gratitude, which comes specifically from a recognizing that there's more there than what you see. Leah says Hoda'a when she has her fourth child, because this is more than what I can possibly have or thought I could have had or could have contained, and it's there anyway. And that expression of the gratitude comes when you recognize what's not just what you see, but what's more than that. And the sages specifically wanted us to celebrate Chanukah, which is the yontif in which the culture around us, the Greek culture, which again is manifested in the Romans and then later in the Western civilization in which we live, has a lot of beauty to add to the world. Churchill himself did say that. It's a tremendous amount of beauty. But if the sages see in it darkness, they want us to then replace that with beauty. So when you do your mitzvah, you do it in a way that's muhudar. You do it in a beautiful way. And when you celebrate Chanukah, it's a qualitatively different type of beauty, because the beauty that we were up against, which I remember Bill Wine in one of his tapes, I think he said 70, 80% of the Jewish community Hellenized themselves. Which is unfathomable. When you think about what this miracle, what this yontif represents, you're talking about the overwhelming number of Jews abandoned Torah and are Greek. And a small band says they won't give that up. But what they're fighting is such a powerful and beautiful, enlightening culture. If Churchill now can look back and say it's enlightening, imagine what it was like to be living then. And you have your archaic old yeshivas and the rabbis, and you have the modern world. That's a tough battle to fight, and one that overwhelmingly we lost. So when they establish the yontif celebrating our victory, they say we're going to bring beauty into it. And we're going to do it in a mahajan way and a mahajan min mahajan way. That it should be celebrated with beauty, with a beautiful menorah, beautiful oil, and that the way that we qualitatively do it, don't just light one candle, but express how the beauty, like in the windows of the Beis Hamikdash, expands out. One the first night, moving up of Malin Bakodesh Ve'ein Morizim, we go up in levels of sanctity and we don't go down. And a culture which brought so much light and so much beauty in, when we celebrate its defeat, and it's the type of defeat that's still ongoing, each Golus continues on until we get to the final end. We will celebrate that specifically in a beautiful way to say that the true beauty is not just expressed on the outside, but has a bursting value inside which can't even be contained. And so many, all the aspects of a holiday express some form of a beauty in that way to be able to try and express that.
Does this have anything to do with the fact that the imahos were all listed as beautiful?
Yeah, the imahos also were. That's true. He mentioned that in his article.
It shouldn't be just inside, but the package was also
pretty. Yeah, yeah. That there's there's an element of physical beauty describing, you know, our matriarchs, our imahos, that we wouldn't necessarily think is a trait that's necessarily valued, but it is, because there's an expression from the inside out, and that there is a beauty on the outside as well. Have freilich and Chanukah, enjoy, and thanks for coming out.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.